Good morning, everyone. We are reading in Book 7, the Book of Yoga, Canto 6, which is called Nirvana and the All-Negating Absolute. I think we stopped at line 336 on page 541. Page 541, line 336. There's another cushion. We are following Savitri in the journey of her yoga. The first canto of this book showed Savitri being brought by her parents and marriage party to the forest, to the hermitage where Satyavan is living with his parents. It is summertime, and of course she's extremely happy. She experiences the joy of union, of being able at last to marry Satyavan and to live with him and his parents in the forest. She's left behind the palace where she was a pampered princess. Now she will serve her parents-in-law. It's very beautifully described how she undertakes all these duties and does them with joy and humility, love. But when the rainy season comes, then she realizes that time is passing. She only has 1 year before the day when Satyavan must die. And she becomes acutely aware of the passing of time. And this is an agony for her. She has to pass through the ordeal of the foreknowledge of the death of her beloved husband. And she can't share that knowledge with anyone. She has to keep it secret within herself. So that difficult time goes on until the rainy season is approaching its end. And then one night when she's sitting silently beside sleeping Satyavan, a voice comes down to her and everything in her becomes extremely concentrated and quiet. And that voice tells her, "What are you doing? You are an immortal soul. You've come to earth with a mission. Why are you just sitting here and controlling your grief? You have to do something. You have to find your inmost soul. And then you will have the power to conquer death." So there's a response from Savitri's soul. And she undertakes this quest to find her soul. And to do that, she's also guided that since she's come as a representative of humanity, she must find her soul within the physical body. She will have to pass through the layers of the subtle body and find deep in the heart center, find her soul, the home of her soul. And that journey takes her through several cantos. Before in Canto 5, she comes to that innermost place where her soul is dwelling, as if in a rock temple, a cave temple. And there she enters inside and sees wonderful symbolic carvings and figures, conscious in stone. And she realizes that she's coming close to her soul, and a deep identity wakes up within her, and she can identify with all these wonderful figures of gods and goddesses. Behind them she sees one figure, but she still has to go on further until through the last tunnel dug in the rock she passes through into a place where it's full of light and flame. And there it's as if she has to pass through a wall of flames. And on the other side, she encounters her central being. And we read the beautiful section where Sri Aurobindo explains to us that the true soul, our truest soul, is divine, eternal. But it projects a little soul. There are seats in the courtyard, I think, aren't there? A little soul, no bigger than the soul of man, than the thumb of man. Yeah. And this is the representative of the soul in us, which supports our individual being and helps us to bear all the difficulties of life. And at the end of the section, these two parts of Savitri, her highest being and the human portion, they unite and become one. And in the rest of the canto, there's a beautiful description of how she returns to her human awareness sitting in the night, but she's aware of the soul center, and from there she can call. She calls to her highest being to come down and seat itself in her heart. And there's a wonderful description of how, when the Mighty Mother enters her heart, there's a transformation of all the chakras, all the centers. So it's the psychic realization and the psychic transformation. This puts her into a very blissful and confident state. When she looks into the future, she sees that Satyavan will not leave her. He will not die. He will lead a long and full life as a great king. But interrupting this very blissful state, suddenly in the night there comes to her the experience of a dark, negating force which claims to rule everything in the universe. And that experience is so devastating, Sri Aurobindo says, it leaves her inner world laid waste like a desert. And then she's just quietly waiting to see what will come next. And what comes next to her is again a voice from above, which tells her that you have to keep this realization of yours very quiet, very secret. And since you have come not for your own liberation, but to help mankind, you are going to have to widen your consciousness. She needs to undertake the second realization and transformation, the spiritual realization and transformation. She has to widen her consciousness so that it's vaster than the universe, that she can carry the whole of creation within herself. And she's told that to do that, she must detach herself from mind, from sense, and from all these appearances of the creation. And we read how she sits and starts to do that. And the first thing that she does is to observe all the movements in herself, but particularly the many births of thought. Where is the thought coming from? And we just heard Mother reading how Savitri was able to observe that the thoughts are coming from many places. Some come up from the body, or from the inconscient, or the subconscient. Some come from elsewhere, from other people around, and from other parts of the universe, from the subtle worlds. So I think that's where we stopped, on page 541. We'll start reading again at line 337. It's just below the middle of the page. Has everybody got the place? The line starts, "This world is a vast, unbroken totality." Yes, halfway down the page. Will you start, Patricia?
"This world is a vast, unbroken totality. A deep solidarity joins its contrary powers. God's summits look back on the mute abyss. So man, evolving to divinest heights, colloques still with the animals and the jinn, the human godhead with stargazer eyes lives still in one house with the primal beast. The high meets the low, all in a single plan. So she beheld the many births of thought. If births can be, of what eternal is. For the eternal's powers are life himself, timeless in timeless, in time ever born."
Thank you. This world, it means this material manifestation and all the subtle worlds that underlie it. It's all a vast, unbroken totality, a whole in which everything is connected. There are many, many opposite, contrary powers, conflicting powers existing here in this unbroken totality, but they are all connected by a deep solidarity. They are inseparable, in a way, all these opposites. And the summits of the divine look back. They are connected with the mute abyss, the deepest levels. Usually this word we use for the deepest levels of the ocean, but here he means the deepest levels of existence, the inconscient, the subconscious. They are connected. And in this connected wholeness, we human beings are participating in a process of unfolding, evolving from the inconscient matter as we know it has emerged. And out of this matter that we know, we can see that living forms, living consciousnesses have emerged. Mind, mental awareness has emerged. And the evolutionary process is still continuing. It is not finished. No? So, human beings, we human beings, individualized consciousnesses, we are evolving too we are evolving towards divinest heights, but we are still communicating. To kolok, it means to have a conversation with the animal and the jinn. This word jinn, or jinn, all right. Anyway, we know them from the stories of the Arabian Nights, the genies who live in bottles. They are spirits, disembodied spirits, but they're very closely connected with us human beings. And there's a tradition that says that before Adam was given Eve, he was married to a spirit wife, and she is the mother of the genie, of all the jinns. So perhaps these are vital beings, beings of the life plane, subtle life plane, maybe. The human Godhead, the divine soul within the human being, he has stargazer eyes. He's looking upwards to the star, the many stars which represent the many truths. But he's still living, that human soul is living within this physical house, this body of ours. And in this house, there's also still the whole history of the universe, including the primal beast, the lower, much lower vital levels of consciousness. It's all connected. The high meets the low. It's all part of a single plan. So Savitri, becoming aware of that, she sees that from all these different levels, thought gets born. She beheld the many births of thought. And then Sri Aurobindo says, if births can be of something that is eternal, thought is an eternal power. He says, the eternal's powers are like himself, like the one, like the eternal. Timeless, in the timeless, in the transcendent sphere beyond the manifestation. And in time, ever born, born again and again and again and again in all the many, many individualized formations that happen in time. These are the many births of the eternal. Similarly, thought is born again and again in many different forms. Is it clear? Would anybody like to ask anything?
I have a question about line 329.
Yes.
If you will, using the word look back.
If we think of the God summits being on the very highest level, he's looking back down to the very, very lowest level. I know it suggests emergence. Yes. The mute abyss, the silent abyss. Mila, would you read?
These two tools show that only in outer mind is made. Not born, a product perishable, formed in the body's factory by earth force. This mind is a dynamic small machine, producing cessively till it wears out, with raw material drawn from the outside world, the patterns escaped out by an artist's God. Often our thoughts are finished cosmic words, admitted by a silent office gate, and passed through the subconscious galleries, then issued in times marked as private made. For now they bear the living person's stamp, a trick especially few claims than his home. All else is nature's craft, and these two pass. Our tasks are given, we are but instruments. Nothing is all our own that we create. The power that acts in us is not our force.
Thank you. So Savitri has seen the many birds of thought arising from many different parts and levels and places in the universe. But she saw that everything in our outer mind, in our surface mind, which is our normal human consciousness, is not born. It's not something living. It's something made. It's a construction, a formation, a perishable product. It won't last long. And it's been made in the factory of the body through the brain. It's been made by earth force, material force. This mind, this outer mind, is a dynamic, small machine, and it's going on producing thoughts and formations all the time, over and over again, until it wears out. Yes. And it produces all that stuff with raw material, which it draws from the world around it. But somehow the patterns for those products are based on sketches made by an artist god. There is some divine touch there behind them. And often, he says, these thoughts that come to us, they're already made, completed things that have come from the universe. And we let them into our brain, into our mind, our outer mind, as if through a gate, a silent office gate. There's somebody who's checking them. He describes this in other places also. And they get passed through the subconscious. And because they come to us through the subconscious, we don't see where they're coming from. And then they get issued here in time. We think them. They're produced in the market of time as if they're something private that we've thought up by ourselves. Because they have some kind of mark on them because they've passed through our brain. Your brain will be different from my brain. There's some little mark, private mark. Now they bear the stamp, the mark of the living person through whose brain they've passed. Some special color, some little trick, some small difference claims them, the thoughts of that particular person. Apart from that little stamp, everything else is the work of nature. The skill of nature. It's all done. And even that stamp is also a product of nature. What we think, what we do, our tasks are given.
What is ours?
I think what comes from the deep soul. Nothing is all our own that we create. We are just instruments of the cosmic force. The power that acts in us is not our own force. It's the universal force working in us. And now he will tell something very interesting about the very highly developed people, the people who have special skills. Don, would you read it?
I like this is the subconscious galleries, no? That I use this word gallery, you said. What is the picture?
Yes, I think it means there are kind of passages with curved roofs, open passages. There are these passages through our subconscious where the things come in into the brain.
Isn't it also perhaps because what we think may be our thoughts but not, they're already there?
I don't think it means like an art gallery. It's a particular particular sort of structure, kind of an arcaded structure. Helmut, what do you say?
Yeah, I think those kind of messages are art messages.
I see them in the dark kind of messages.
Of course they must be dark, yes. They're in the subconscious. Yeah, they may be kind of tunnels. It's a tunnel. Exactly.
It's a subconscious tunnel.
Thank you, Toan. Thank you. Yes, must be that. Don, you'll read. Can you read loud? There's lots of people today.
The genius too receives from some high fount, concealed in supernal secrecy, the work that gives him an immortal name. The word, the form, the charm, the glory and grace are missioned sparks from a stupendous fire. A sample from the laboratory of God, of which he holds the patent upon earth, comes to him wrapped in golden coverings. He listens for inspiration's postman knock and takes delivery of the priceless gift, a little spoiled by the receiver mind, or mixed with the manufacturer of his brain. When least defaced, then is it most divine.
That's enough. Thank you. Let's look at this wonderful picture. Let's stop there. It is a genius, after all. It's an individual who, in some striking way, produces something, a thought, an insight, a work of art, a supreme way of expression, which takes evolution forward, enriches the human treasure. So even the genius, those special individuals, they become special because they receive from some high fount, some source that's hidden in the supernal secrecy, on a very, very high secret level which we can't reach. Something comes to him, the work, that if he fulfills it, it gives him an immortal name. We remember the names of these great individuals. The word, perhaps he's a poet, or he's a sculptor or an artist, the charm, the glory and grace, all these things are sent to him. They are sparks from a stupendous fire of creativity. These little sparks come, and they are sent specifically to that person. This gift, this spark, comes to him as a sample from the laboratory of God, where all these wonderful experiments, creative efforts are being made. He gets a little packet of it, because he's the person on earth who holds the patent on that particular kind of creativity. It's for him, It comes to him wrapped in golden coverings. And he's listening. He knows something will come if he listens carefully enough for the what comes with inspiration. And it will come to him. It will tell him that it's there. It will give a knock like the postman. Something for you. And he takes delivery of that precious, priceless gift. And it has to pass through his mind. And it may get a little bit spoilt as it passes through. No? Or it will get mixed up. Maybe his brain, which is doing all that manufacturing, that factory, will add something, change something. And when it comes, is least defaced, when it comes in the purest possible way, without any mixture, without any damage, then is it most divine. I think that very, very gifted people, they feel this.
But
and it's in all fields of life. It's not only in art. It's in all fields of life. Yeah. Yes. That he received things. Yes.
Yeah. His last word was, after consciousness is God. He said it before dying.
Yeah.
I think that applies even to what we would consider evil and criminal things. There are people who are genius at being.
Yes, that's a bit more complicated. here he's talking about the geniuses who really carry things forward for humanity. But of course there are these other subtle worlds with highly developed beings in them, and if you're receptive, they may come and do something through you. I think that's what's going to come next. Marie-Ange, will you read?
Although his ego claims the world for its use, man is a dynamo for the cosmic world. Nature does most in him, God the highest. Only his soul can help them in his own. This independent one, the power supreme, self-born before the universe was made, accepting cosmos by himself, nature serves, till he becomes a freedom and
freedman
of God's slave. This is the appearance in our mortal form, our greater truth obeying lies behind. Our consciousness is cosmic and immense, but only when we break through matter's world is that spiritual vastness. Can we stand where we can lead the masters of our world and mind if only a means embody a tool? For above the birth of body and of thought, our spirit's truth lives in the naked self, and from that height, unbound, surveys the world.
Thank you. Anybody would like to ask anything?
I have a question about line 381.
Yes.
Nature does most in hand, God the high rest. Does this mean that God is not a part of nature?
Well, there is a way in which we can, in this world of duality, we make a separation between the unconscious lower nature, which is driving the evolutionary force, and the divine powers above. So I think that's what this line means, that most of us is driven by evolutionary nature, which is not yet fully conscious, and yet there's still some influence from God. And the third and vital element is our own. Lyuba asked, what is our own? Here's the answer. Only our soul's acceptance is our own. That's what's special about human beings, that we do have, we are gifted a power of choice. And because we have to choose, we are also to an extent gifted by the power of discrimination.
The line before, man is a dynamo for the cosmic world.
So what is a dynamo? What does it do? Doesn't it produce energy?
It changes the mechanical energy into electrical energy.
Okay, so that's where kind of converter for one kind of energy into another kind. And we are made like that for the cosmic work. No, for this cosmic work. What is the cosmic work? The cosmic work is this vast unfolding which is going on in every part of the universe. And so we are playing a part in that. Human beings play a special kind of part, this conversion of unconscious energy into hopefully more conscious energy. Yes. Yeah.
What if this tree becomes her freedman?
Yes, so it's so only his soul's acceptance is his own. So this, his soul, the soul is independent. It was once a supreme power. I've often mentioned this, that our true individuality is eternal, infinite, and somehow we have been offered the choice and we've accepted that yes, a part of our true soul will be projected into the material world to participate in this particular cosmic work. So when we do that, when we are self-born, well, we were self-born before the universe was made, but we've accepted to become part of this cosmos. And by doing that, by accepting, we have agreed to be the serf of nature. A serf is almost a slave. The soul has accepted to enter into domination by the force of evolving material nature. And the soul remains like that until at a certain point in his development, his work here, he becomes the freed man of nature. A freed man is a slave who has been set free and becomes a free citizen. Or he may choose, instead of being a free citizen participating in the work of nature, he may accept to become the slave of the Supreme, God's slave.
It's not the same.
It's apparently not quite the same. Not quite the same. So, but then Sri Aurobindo says, this is how it looks on our mortal front, this frontal appearance which is dominated by death, because we are physical beings. We have to pass again and again through this process of formation and dying. But our greater truth of being is lying behind all this, behind this surface mind. Our true inner consciousness is universal, immense. But we can't participate in that greater consciousness which belongs to us, which is of which we are also a part, only when we break through this wall of matter. When we can stand in the spiritual vastness. There, our souls, our true beings, can become masters of the world, using mind and body, where mind is only a means and body a tool. Above the birth of body and of thought, the truth of our spirit lives in its naked self, not covered up by all these clothes and appearances of matter. And from that height, free, unbound, it looks down and surveys the world, and it can act from that height on the world. Something to share, Tuan?
No, it's people out there that have an assignment.
Yes. So that this is that what she does next. Yeah. Kavita, would you read?
After my Shiro took shape its Lord, that it might sleep in some deep shadow of her, or fall silent in the silence of the unseen. High she attained and stood from the nature free, and saw creation's light from far above. Then upon all she laid her sovereign will to dedicate it to God's timeless calm. Then all grew tranquil in her being state. Only sometimes small thoughts arose and fell, like quiet waves upon a silent sea, or ripples passing over a lonely pool. When a stray stone disturbs its dreaming rest.
Thank you. Savitri understands this possibility of rising up above body and thought and entering into the spirit's truth. So she wills and rises up out of the mind to be able to escape its control, its law, so that the mind can fall asleep in some deep shadow of self, or fall silent in the silence of the unseen. So she's able to rise very high so that she is free from the control of the nature, material and subtle nature forces. She sees the whole creation from far above. And from that height, thence means from there, she wills, she laid her sovereign will to dedicate everything in herself to God's timeless calm. So everything in the being becomes calm, tranquil. And there's this beautiful picture, and there's a painting of it, that only sometimes small thoughts arose and fell, like quiet waves upon a silent sea, or ripples passing over a lonely pool when a stray stone disturbs its dreaming rest. A stray stone. As if somebody passes that lonely pool and a little stone gets dislodged, falls in, then the ripples spread very quietly. She's dedicating herself to that, but I don't think it is fully achieved yet. Mm-hmm. We will see further. Mm-hmm. Things have quietened down in the mind, but we will see it's not yet completely silent. She's not yet completely free. Yes, Don.
I have a slight bad feeling about the word that is said, not slave. In the sense that slave is a commodity in society. It can be bought, sold, passed on, and so on. Is the relation of Savitri to God that? I'm sorry,
No, Sri Aurobindo uses these paradoxical phrases to make us think a little bit beyond these clichés, no? Why would you want to become a slave? So, if you realize that the supreme will is really the only thing that the will of your soul wants, then you say, "You Lord, you do it all. You tell me what to do. I will try to do whatever you tell me."
Just the words to me.
I have the same thing going on, and I would use servant. Servant, because there's even a great movie once about the servant, a British film, that you're giving service, but slave is like.
No, you lose the freedom of your own will. You voluntarily surrender.
That description is wonderful there, the word slave is.
No, but you can use the slave what it's worth. But that doesn't mean
every experience in
the world. It involves ownership. That's the difference between servant and slave. You belong to him.
Yes, ma'am.
Is it connected to the sentence, one must be a willing servitor of the divine consciousness?
Yes.
Well, that is more what Loretta is talking about, no? Being a willing servitor. You accept and you try to find out what the divine will is and you try to follow it. You still have a will of your own. But I think what is implied by this term, God's slave, and we will see it, we will see Savitri exemplifying this later on. It is that she has no more separate existence at all. So no will of her own, no independent will.
And
here to learn. Yes. And Mother does not insist on that.
No.
It's something else that's really becoming a highly advanced yogi, becoming God's slave. So what Mother needs is willing servitors.
It's like a Krishna Das, Deva Das.
Yes.
A Das is like a Das, and you are just there to do whatever the
Yes.
So,
you can
use that word.
I think in servant, there's still a bit of the ego left.
Yes. Well, let's see when we get to the end of the book. When we get to the end of this book of yoga, we will see what it's like to be the slave of God. No? Yes. Yes.
Now you said that Mother wants us to be a willing servitor. So that is because she wants to create through us.
She's given it as a condition for living in Auroville.
Yeah.
Auroville belongs to no one in particular, it belongs to humanity as a whole. But to live in Auroville, one should be a willing servitor of the divine consciousness. So it's one of the criteria for being a true Aurovillian.
That means you should exert your own will as well?
Yes.
You have to align your own will with the divine purpose.
Freely.
Yes. Willingly. Servus is a slave, a person who serves.
No, a slave has no own will. So what she said, you should not exert your own will. That's the opposite of being a slave.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's total surrender.
That's the true freedom.
That's slavery. He has a big taste, I think, about slavery, because in recent history, slavery came out rather in an awkward situation and negative vibe. In this sense, it's totally positive, but you have no own decision right. You can't say, if you're a slave, I don't do it. You can, but you will be punished. As simple as that.
And of course, this is why he uses this word to draw attention to this, that we can have this little discussion.
You choose to be his slave.
He's very nice.
Okay.
Yes, Don.
To go back to the slave again, if you read the accounts of the slaves in America, the black slaves of America there, they had a will of their own, and they created a culture and everything like that. They couldn't exert it beyond that which the master demanded of them. Master was kind, fine and well. The master was brutal and cruel. That's the way it went. But they had a will, they had created, they had a...
Of course they were human beings. Yeah. All slaves are human beings.
But they were slaves of their own choice.
They couldn't exercise the choice.
Yeah, it's not their choice to be slaves. They would surrender to the slavery, right? That's why they were doing so.
Let's go on.
Sorry,
yes.
Then one thing I want
to yes, Masumi.
In Advaita Vedanta, it says that Tao Ati, that is
yes.
Sarvam Kalitam Brahma or Tattavasi,
yes.
Tao Ati. When we are one, we have the goal to become one with Him.
Yes.
When we are one with Him, then there is no slavery.
There's no separation even. Yes.
And when there is separation, then we have to follow His will.
We have that delight of choosing to be His slave.
Yes.
And the greatest delight is when one can have experience both of these states at the same time. No, when one is one with the one, and at the same time you can feel, yes, but I'm here, He's manifested me in a body, and I can be His slave,
yeah.
Or playmate, or lover, or whatever. No, yeah. Thank you.
There's a song of what Leonard Cohen sang about I'm Your Slave. It's a beautiful song.
Yeah.
It captured something of the willingness.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's go on. So the stray stone, little ripples on the mind. But then she notices, who's next, Stefani?
Yes. Yet the mind factory had ceased to work. There was no sound of the dynamo's throb. There came no call from the still fields of life. Then even those stirrings rose in her no more. Her mind now seemed like a vast empty room, or like a peaceful landscape without sound. These men called quietude and pride as peace. But to her deeper side, all yet was there. A further thing like a chaos underneath. Feeling and thought cried out for warmth and end, but found no response in the silent grave. All was afraid, but nothing yet existed. At every moment, my explosion comes.
Thank you. Perhaps if you go regularly to Matrimandir to concentrate, you might notice something like this.
Mm-hmm.
That everything is very tranquil in the being. The mind seems to be quiet, like a vast empty room or a peaceful landscape. Without sound. And we value that peace, that quietude, very, very much. But Savitri looks deeper and she sees that even in that state, everything's still going on, bubbling away underneath the control that you've exerted to make your mind quiet. The feelings and the thoughts, they're all still there. It's just that they don't find any response because she's laid away a will of silence on the brain. Everything was suppressed, but nothing yet expunged. It's all still there. So at every moment, explosion might come. Yeah. Somebody bangs the door or kicks something. It can happen. Yes? It can happen.
Yeah. The usual expression is that at any moment,
Yes.
At any moment, and he says every. So yeah. It really is kind of surprised.
But then it could, the experience goes on. I'm sorry, I keep forgetting Alessia's name.
Then these two cause the body seeing the stone. Oh, now was a wide, mighty vacancy, but still excluded from eternity's touch. For still was far the repose of the absolute, and the ocean silence of infinity. Even now some thoughts would pause for solitude. These surge not from the depths or from the deep, cast up from formlessness to seek a form. Spoke not the body's need, nor voice life's call. These things not born, nor made in human time. Children of cosmic nature from a far world, ideal shapes in concrete armor of work, posted like travelers in an alien space. Out of some far expanse, they seem to come as if carried on vast wings like large white sails, and with easy access reach the inner ear as though they used a natural privilege right to the higher royal entries of the soul.
Thank you. So what she's experiencing now is still not the transcendent spiritual silence, the absolute silence, the ocean silence of infinity. Still, some thoughts could come to her, but these seem to be very special thoughts. They're not coming up from within, from the depths, not coming up from formlessness to seek a form. They're not responding to the need of the body. They're not expressing some call of the life. These seemed not born nor made in human time. They're from some other dimension. These are children of cosmic nature from a far world. And they come already completely clothed in expressive words. Perhaps this is how the mantra comes to the Rishi. It's a very high thought that comes along with its perfect expression. And it seems to be moving through a strange space, not the mind space, an alien space. They seem to come from very, very far away, as if they're sailing ships, large white sails. And they know exactly where they're going. Nothing stops them. They easily reach the inner ear as though they have a natural right to enter there, the high royal entries of the soul. So she looks to see where they're coming from. Will you read it?
As yet, no. The vault lay deep, concealed in light. Then looking to know whence the introducers came, she saw a spiritual immensity pervading and encompassing the world space as ether or our transparent tangible air. And through it sailing
tranquilly
a thought, as smoothly glides a ship nearing its port, ignorant
of embargo and blockade, confident of entrance and the visa seal. It came to the silent city of the brain towards its accustomed and expectant place.
Key.
But met a bearing will, a blow of force, and sank vanishing in the immensity.
Thank you. So when she looks to see where they're coming from, she becomes aware of this spiritual immensity, this vast space that is pervading as well as encompassing the world space. It's penetrating it. It's a finer kind of substance. It can penetrate the world space that we think is a vacuum. Sri Aurobindo says, gives the analogy, the comparison, that ether pervades and encompasses our air, our atmosphere in this way. The scientists have decided that ether doesn't exist, but Sri Aurobindo repeatedly refers to it. He considers that there is this finest, rarest substance that the ancients called ether. So it's a spiritual immensity, pervading, penetrating, like a perfume filling the air of a room, and encompassing, enveloping the world space in the same way ether surrounds our transparent, tangible air. And these thoughts are sailing on that atmosphere. They sail tranquilly, peacefully, they post. And they come, it's as if there's a ship moving towards the port. It knows exactly where to go. It doesn't realize that there's an embargo, a blockade, that it will not be allowed to enter. It's come that way many times before. It doesn't expect to be blocked like that. It's confident that it will be able to enter, that it will get its visa and be permitted to enter. So it comes approaching the silent city of Savitri's brain towards that place where it usually docks, its accustomed key that's waiting for it. But it meets this barring will, Savitri's will for silence. A blow of force, as if somebody has shot a cannon at it. Immediately it sinks into that subtle, etheric immensity. You like to read, Norm?
After a long vacant pause, another appeared. And others, one by one, suddenly emerged, minds unexpected visitors from the unseen, like far-off sails on a lonely sea. But soon, as colors failed, none reached mind's coast. Then all grew still, nothing moved anymore. Immobile, self-wrapped, timeless,
thank you. Sri Aurobindo was able to evoke these experiences to our imaginations because he had experienced these things himself, and particularly this last part, last couple of sentences. We know that this is how he reached his experience of being a silent spirit pervading silent space. This is Sri Aurobindo's first major spiritual realization. which came to him in January 1908, when he sat with the Maharashtrian yogi, Lele, who surprised Sri Aurobindo by telling him that thoughts don't come in, are not produced in the brain, they come in from outside. Sri Aurobindo says he had never heard of that idea before. But Lele told him, you concentrate, and when you see a thought approaching, you stop it. Don't allow it to enter. So he practiced that and found it immensely powerful, sinking the thoughts as it's described here. And as a result, already with one day, and after 3 days, he had reached this state that he later described as the experience of the silent Brahman. Brahman. It is. It's the goal of many yogas, you know, this experience. It's considered as moksha, as liberation. For Sri Aurobindo, it was his first major spiritual realization, and he made it the basis, or it was made the basis, for his other subsequent realizations. Sorry? That was 1908, in January, the first week of January. We don't know exactly which day, but it was in the first week of January, 1908. And we shall see that Savitri also reaches this state, and like Sri Aurobindo, she will persist. It will persist for some time. And then another experience will come, as it came to him. It will be described very, very beautifully in the next section, but I think that's a suitable place for us to stop today. We can listen to Mother reading some passages from this part of the poem. No, we'll just listen to three. I think we can just listen to the last three.
Only sometimes small thoughts arose and fell like quiet waves upon a silent sea. All ripples passing over a lonely pool, when a starry stone disturbs its dreaming rest. Then all grew still, nothing moved anymore, immobile, self-wrapped, timeless, solitary, a silent spirit pervading silent space. Unutterably effaced, no one annulled, a vanished vestige, like a violet trace, a faint record, merely of a self now past. She was a point in the unknowable.
shop indoors.